is your captain speaking. Today we had a few technical issues crop up with the microphones and things, and so unfortunately, the audio quality might not be as high as you would expect from this show. A new audio interface is on the way, but in the meantime, we still have stories, and of course the show must always go on. With twilight setting in, it is now time for your scheduled presentation.
Well, it's another week, and I hope you're having a good one. I wanted to share a couple things this episode. We've got a short story that I wrote quite a number of years ago now, and it feels like it's been such a long time, and yet it hasn't been such a long time at the same time. I don't know how that's possible, but both things are happening simultaneously. And this is a story that I just keep coming back to, and especially recently, it's just been on my mind. It's a story that I wrote while I was working at this crazy, crazy place. It was a completely chaotic work environment. There was nothing that was sane about it. Management was insane. Dealing with the clientele was insane. My schedule got to be kind of insane. And at the time I was working this job and I was starting up my own business. And so I was kind of, I guess you might say, burning the candle at both ends. Yeah, I was kind of starting to reach my limit and I was having some problems with my health and managing the stress of all these different things going on. And ended up writing this story that was just completely different from everything else that I was working on, everything else that I had put into my first collection, The Mirror Opened. And so I wanted to share this with you tonight and then talk a little bit about it afterward. And then from there, maybe we'll read some poetry or some other things. So this is a story called Holiday Blues. I had convinced myself that before leaving work, I'd forgotten to turn the stove off. Sitting in the four walls of my cubicle, running the end of my finger over a ballpoint pen, tapping it on the desk. Had I left it on medium high? The flame glowing blue and filling the air with the smell that always comes before the firemen arrive? I thought about the papers scattered over my desk, the pieces that made up an incomplete first novel, or what would have been my first novel, if it wasn't curling in the orange heat that was leaving a trail of destruction as it passed through my apartment. All I could do was think about it, and I'd started grinding my teeth. Martha, the next door angel, would have been happy to grab the spare key in the backyard and check for me, but she was going to be gone for 2 weeks. I focused on the desk calendar. The 23rd of December. She'd be with her family decorating the tree, and all the while the world back home would be burning. Maybe it would be worth calling anyway. Yes, Martha? I don't know what to do, but I think our apartment complex might be burning down. You want to come home a little early so we can sing carols and make snow angels in the ashes? She wouldn't be able to do anything about it. Somewhere in the office, Jingle Bell Rock played over tinny computer speakers, and I couldn't stop running my fingers along my temples. And of course, it's today, of all fucking days. It was too much to sit there, so I abandoned station and took a walk over to the break room. Nobody was there at the water cooler to interrupt with small talk, and at least there was that to be thankful for. 2 months ago had been a different era. 2 months ago, I'd started writing again, an old pastime I kept between women as they passed through my life like a highway. It wasn't easy shaking the last one, because while most drive with purpose and responsibility, this one had decided to jackhammer the asphalt before going on her way. An icy wound before the change in seasons.
No, Ryan.
I think we just want different things. It's all my fault, really. Not a hint of sorrow in her voice as she sat in the dining room table, and it was before work. It had to have been before work. She'd already moved all her things, and after her announcement, she was on the road and taking a different exit. But at least it's not the end of the world to realize your girlfriend of 2 years is a whore. That's why 2 months ago I could bear going to work, and I could bear filling the void with words. I could bear keeping a smile on my face and pretending I had something to come home to after my shift, because even if it wasn't a person, there was the project. 5 hours at night, tapping at a keyboard and seeing a world unfold before me. At least with fiction, the love is always real. But maybe it wouldn't be anymore. 2 months and 200 pages gone with an honest mistake, and it would take everything else down with it. I thought of the last 2 paychecks I'd neglected to deposit, sitting on my office filing cabinet. I thought of the list of numbers I'd written down that morning, and one of them was undoubtedly for a respectable literary agent. But mostly I thought about the words. I thought about the paper turning black as the printed ink, and the withered memories of what I had completed so far. Would it be possible to recreate those words? Staring that in the face made me shudder. It would be like building the whole house up again from the charred wreckage, with no reliable blueprint, no feeling that it would ever look like it once had. And for this mistake, for this loss, they would want money. The insurance companies, the state, whoever else wanted to milk the opportunity dry. They'd try to lock me up for negligence or reckless behavior if they could find any excuse. I ran my fingers over the water cooler's plastic top, touching, but not really feeling. The only one left in this situation was Ben Harrison, general manager. Time off was given out like an annual lottery, and there were plenty of times where it seemed nobody was ever winning. But I wondered if maybe he'd understand this time. Maybe he'd put a hand on my shoulder and wish me on my way. But for 30 minutes, and 30 minutes only. So I wiped away the sweat, and I knocked on his door. His shape moved closer behind the fogged glass, and Harrison cracked the door open just enough to stick his head out. Onslow? What do you need? Yeah, sir, I need to leave the office for a few minutes. I think that... Do you know what day it is, Onslow? There is no time to be behind on anything. Yes, I understand, sir, but I think I left my stove on. Your stove? Are you trying to make something up? No. No, I'm serious. I think I left it on and I need to make sure nothing's burning. You don't have anything to be worried about. Do you have anything on the stove? Yes. I lied. And in any case, I don't want to risk a fire. Onslow, if you really thought your home was at risk, you would just walk out the door. You wouldn't wait 30 minutes to tell me right now. I know all the tricks, Onslow. We don't hand out second breaks here. He shut the door and disappeared behind the glass once more. If I could have gotten his head in my hands, I would have torn his jaw off with brute force. I would have screamed in his ear and slammed a fist down onto the bridge of his nose and beaten in his forehead. I would have lobotomized him with the ballpoint pen in my breast pocket, but instead, I walked back to my desk, head in hands. Snow beat down on the office windows, but nothing in me cared to take more than a passing glance. Jingle Bell Rock had long passed, and in its place was Billie Holiday singing how she has her love to keep her warm. People always talk about what they want for Christmas. They bitch about how they had to wait 2 hours to buy a new phone, and bitch even more when they couldn't get it in the color they wanted. People want phones for Christmas more than they want time with their family or friends. Hell, I thought more than once about calling up a buddy or two. But most people have things to come home to. Even the ones I call friends. They disappear for 2 weeks, just like Martha, and in the meantime, everyone I do talk to asks me what I'm doing for the holidays. If I didn't know better, I'd tell them I'm drinking a beer and putting a gun in my mouth. I tell myself if only I knew a few other corporate loser scum like me, we'd make Christmas great. Day of, we'd throw roasts and a barbecue, crack bottles of whiskey and reminisce. Joke, laugh, have one hell of a time. For one night, it wouldn't matter if we had nothing to come home to. But that could only be a nice thought from someone who couldn't stand to be alone anymore. Right? Are you okay? Carol from two prison cells down. I just saw you earlier and you just seem upset. I am upset, I told her. I'm not sure if I can take all of this anymore.
Take what?
What did I miss? I don't know, Carol. I don't know if I can take this job anymore. I think my house is burning down and Harrison isn't going to let me leave.
You're kidding. Why would it be on fire?
Breakfast this morning. I think I left the stove on.
Well, can't you call your girlfriend?
She should be able to check, right? I hadn't said anything about her. Not a word. And I didn't plan to. No, she can't. She got called in to fill at another location at her job. Carol, there isn't anything you can do about this. She stopped. Cold realization showing on her face, and she pulled her hand away from the top of the cubicle, like she was afraid I'd bite it off. All right, then. Well, let me know if you think of anything. You know, we're all here for you, Ryan. You're part of the team.
Oh, you're fucking not, I said. And I don't understand why all of you pretend you are. You don't understand all the shit I'm dealing with. You just fucking don't. I'm sick and tired of these charades and games where we pretend to be friends and pretend things are all so fucking great when it's all so goddamn miserable. But none of you care about me. You don't. I just come here to work. That's that.
And even though I felt deep down that this was the end, it didn't hit me completely until I had stormed my way out of the building and into the parking lot, feeling the fresh snow on my face as I found my car. I watched the office disappear behind me in the rearview mirror, and I wondered if it would be for the last time, as an employee at least. Through the snow and holiday traffic, I inched through until it gave way to my neighborhood. I drove around a block of houses twice to kill time, because there was nothing I could do to prepare myself. I turned the corner and pulled up to an apartment building that stood the same as it always had. Parking lot empty with the time of year. I treaded up the walkway to my front door, brushed the snow that had been collecting on the knob, and went inside to a place that had remained exactly as it had been left. The carpet was still its pristine beige, and there was the lingering scent of the bacon and eggs that had been breakfast. There wasn't any smoke to be seen as I entered the kitchen, and looking down at the dial on the stove, the burner turned to a bold red off. But I didn't breathe a sigh of relief. I didn't fall to my knees, and thank God I hadn't made a mistake. Instead, I turned around the corner and walked to my desk.
I gathered my manuscript together and came back to the kitchen, removing the dirty pan on the range and replacing it with the neatly stacked pages. Then I turned the stove on to high and walked back. I didn't even close the door before climbing into my car and driving away. There's a chance someone will find me. Sometime, some place. It could be someone from work, maybe a long-lost friend who recognizes my dirtied mug, or maybe a cop. There's no telling who'll find me, or if they'll see the dull light in my eyes. Maybe those lights will say something about what I've been through. But more than anything, I hope that for once, I'll see someone as tired and empty as me. Somebody who is just as much to come home to at night. Only a couple days till Christmas. This year, I'm getting a new life. Now, at the time when I wrote this story, I didn't quite realize what I was getting into. I saw that there was something interesting about it. There was something different about it. And I really wasn't sure what anybody would think about it. I'm not sure if it really fit in with all my work at that time. And looking back on it now, I think it is actually probably, dare I say it, one of the better things from that time. And the reason is because it actually highlights one of the biggest problems with people. And that is the sort of the working level of irrationality that people have. People do not, and also at the same time, people don't want to believe that they're irrational. They would like to present themselves as logical, sound, productive human beings. But inside every human being, there is something that is very dark and very irrational. And this has actually been proven scientifically, believe it or not. I read this book that was sort of about human behavior and marketing. But one of the guy's main arguments was actually that human beings are irrational. And he proved this with a bunch of different sort of surveys and studies. And he was able to show that depending on how you phrase a question, you can actually influence the way, you know, the answers people give, which, you know, it seems like such an obvious thing, but it's kind of amazing because the people that he was trying to explain this concept to did not feel comfortable admitting that they were irrational. These were, you know, highly educated, top of management, you know, top of their career sort of people, in all kinds of big fields, and even they are just as irrational as everybody else. And that's kind of what made his discovery sort of unpopular. But it is so true. And I think that is why this story works the way it does. There is something that highlights that irrationality, because we have all had an experience where we thought we left the stove on, or thought we left the curling iron on, or thought we left the door unlocked or something. And there's that nagging thought that just keeps coming back. Everybody knows what that nagging thought is. And the frightening thing about it is that when those thoughts are unhindered And the way they become more unhindered is through higher and higher emotional states, or I guess lower emotional states, right? But the deeper you go into negative emotions, the more they begin to override reality in the person's mind. And so you have this situation in this story. What happened? The guy had a single thought that he had left his oven on. And what he could have done, he could have, if he had known, seen the irrationality of the thought, said, you know what? I didn't do that. But the thought is just so nagging and so convincing that it keeps growing. And it's like, well, maybe I've lost everything. I've already lost so much. What if I just lost all this? And so he's sort of already coping with the fact that he's lost everything, even though he hasn't. And this is the horror of the mind. And to take it to even the next level, he finds out that all of his fears weren't real. And sort of as a way to deal with that, he actually creates the problem that he had imagined. He actually created the horrifying reality that did not have to exist. And this is something that people do all the time. This is how people self-destruct. And another interesting line that had jumped out to me after, you know, I haven't read this story since I wrote it, basically, but at the end, he says, I want to see someone as tired and empty as me. And that is exactly the nature of this kind of evil that takes hold in people. They want to spread that misery to others. And so what starts out as a fear and sort of like a self-preservation sort of thing becomes this aggressive, nasty, outward attack on others. And it's all self-destructive, and it's just a horror show. But people, you know, you see it all the time. You talk to someone who's lived on the street for years and years and years, and they'll probably have a story like that to tell you. I guess another thing I can say about this story is that I actually recently witnessed this kind of thing happen, where I don't want to say it was a small thing went wrong. It was like, you know, it was like a serious enough thing to where it's like, this is not good. But at the same time, it's not like the end of the world. It's not like losing your house in a fire. It wasn't that type of thing. This woman was so upset over this thing that had happened. It was an accident. Could not have been foreseen beforehand or stopped or anything. It was going to happen. I noticed that animal response to the problem. And she just starts being like, oh, this is so terrible. This is such a terrible place to work. Everybody is just like, who's going to get screwed today? That's how it goes here. You know, she started going on the kind of rant. And it reminded me of this story. I was like, wow. She's like, I'm going to give him my keys and I'm going to tell him I ain't going to take this anymore. She kept saying it over and over again. I'm going to quit. And I saw very clearly that there was no problem. Like, yeah, there was a problem. But the problem is limited to the next 20 minutes or so to fix it. Just the manual labor to fix the problem. And in her mind, that process was already long, past beginning, where it was just starting to explode, starting to crack under pressure. This kind of just thing, this thing happens all the time. And it honestly, in most cases, has nothing to do with the outside world. It really doesn't. It has everything to do with the internal state of the person. Because if the internal state of the person could be different, that situation would never happen. All right, so for this next segment here, I'm going to read some poetry. I don't know, maybe we'll call this poetry night. Poetry reading. And, you know, I know what a lot of people say about poetry. You know, honestly, most people probably don't like poetry. If I had to take a guess. Like, yeah, you know, everybody's maybe got a poem that they like. But poetry as a whole is kind of just like a mess. And that was my view of it, at least when I sort of got into it. And I ended up finding a couple poets that I enjoyed. They're kind of, you know, few and far between. But I realized there is sort of a magic to writing poetry. But it's got to be done a certain way. And I have my own way that I like to do it. At first, I wasn't even sure what to call it because I didn't want to call it poetry. It feels like a non-mechanic going around saying he fixes cars. Like, I'm not really a poet, right? Nonetheless, I find it a very enjoyable form, and I think part of the reason I like poetry is because it's the type of writing where I feel like you don't really have to explain it, because the poem should explain itself. And even the best stories, you could say, the best art in general, sort of needs no explanation, because everything that you need is packaged into it. With every line, every brushstroke, whatever it is. And so it's a way to get an idea down, a big idea in a few lines. Or maybe a number of lines, numerous lines, but you can really get down to the heart of an idea. So I'll read this one. It's called American Dream. On a dark night, when the rain wouldn't stop beating down and I couldn't still my restless heart, I wandered through the forest. For 7 dark nights I wandered, and slept at dawn. I wandered through the nothing, looking for the American dream. I found robbers and candle makers, poisoned bread and broken watches. I saw chickens without their heads and blood-soaked hounds tearing the flesh from each other's bones. I found tax collectors and lost people forming dirty parodies of society under trees and bridges alike. I found endless doctors and suffocating bills and unhappy people. I saw parents dismantling their children and children dismantling their parents. I saw snakes eating themselves and cannibals with no one to eat. I found a dog with a missing leg. He was sporting a pot belly full of worms and no left eye, and that dog was happier than anyone I'd ever met. I saw bloated highways of bug-like vehicles driving off a cliff, with no one behind them stopping to wonder what it's really all about. I saw people eating shotguns on their rooftops in the rain. I saw churches paved with bones, and grown men and women that had long forgotten what it was like to be a child. I saw house spires and crocodiles and all kinds of bloodsuckers. I saw rotting meat and rotten brains and problems that no amount of money can solve. I had feet full of broken glass and eyes full of tears and no one around to hear the screams but God himself. I found all that, and a lot more, but I still haven't found the American dream. And since we were talking about jobs today, I figure I'll read this one. It's called Honest Job. And it's actually a true story, believe it or not. I'd just been laid off, so my life lost all meaning. I'd wanted a job so bad I'd even considered becoming a salesman. I saw a little nondescript ad for the position. The job in question seemed to involve traveling door to door and selling old people solar panels. Old people could be grumpy, but you'll do just about anything if you're scared enough. I didn't have a car, but they advertised transportation for all employees. What could make this any better? I got a call from one of their headhunter girls within a week. I was scheduled to have an interview with Michael. Interview day rolled around. I tidied up my hair, shaved, put on a blazer and a clean white-collared shirt, and walked through a cloudy, humid day and into the square where this business supposedly resided. But I couldn't find it. I stopped inside a coffee shop and made sure my crisp image was still in place. I wandered door to door until finally I reached a darkened glass door I'd never noticed any time I'd been out there. Sure enough, a walk backward revealed the worn-out numbers indicating that this was indeed my place of potential employment. I walked in, and within seconds, I knew I wouldn't stay there long. The first thing I noticed was a long line of those cheap fold-out tables, usually reserved for birthday parties and awkward high school reunions. Each table was covered in its own unique knot of cables and power strips, and each table sat four or five people, each uniquely miserable-looking. Every face was shiny with sweat and dark around the eyes. There was a cluttered corner near the front door that was home to an equally shiny secretary. "You're here for an interview?" she asked. "Yes." "Who with?" "Michael." "Great. He'll be out shortly. In the meantime, you can have a seat on the couch." I looked behind me. It was definitely a couch. But it didn't look like it would stay a couch for long. One of the legs was missing and was held up with a couple thick books. Another guy walked in, hair slicked back. I was just a guy pretending he wanted to be a salesman. This guy was born ready for the part. His hair was greasier than a fry cook at the end of his shift. His teeth were polished. He took off his glasses before he asked if I was interviewing here as well. I told him I was. He said he was here for an interview. In fact, this was his third interview. He disappeared outside with a cigarette clasped between his fingers. Inside, the flustered, sweaty computer people were half listening to a video call taking place on a huge projector on the back wall. The main executive was dropping short, sharp sentences with explosive punctuation. "If we're doing things right, you can make at least one fucking sale per day. Otherwise, what the fuck are we doing?" One of those poor people looked on the verge of tears. So there I sat on the couch, staring at the broken coffee pot when Michael finally walked in. He smiled at me like he'd just written his suicide note that morning. "Hi, you're Chris?" "Yeah, that's me." I followed him through the offices, which spiraled into a hellish maze that ended in a tiny, dingy little room with random crap laying everywhere. He had a picture of himself and his young boy and a mug decorated with football stickers that said, "Best Dad," which told me everything I needed to know. The guy asked me a bunch of questions that didn't matter. I also realized that this so-called employer-provided transportation was about as legitimate as any other aspect of this business. I've forgotten most of those interview questions, but I remember him asking, "What I do to handle adversity?" My brain, having left the building a long time ago, thought he said, "Diversity." I managed to pull something out of my ass in that exact moment that fit exactly with every other aspect of this so-called business. I said something about respecting people's differences and boundaries and whatever garbage they want you to recite at a job interview. I don't know how he kept a straight face, but he shook my hand like he was afraid of giving me a highly contagious salesman disease, and I walked out of there. I had never been happier to remain unemployed. I found out later that those guys were apparently embezzling lots of money to put towards a ton of cocaine. So if you see a young guy with greased up hair and a limp noodle handshake, don't feel bad about shutting the door in his face. He's got bigger problems ahead of him. So with that, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Midnight Presentation. If you want to find more writing, more stories, art, illustrations, and all sorts of other goodies, you can visit the website at midnightauthor.com, where you can find my blog, my books, and of course this podcast, and you can listen to all the episodes. This podcast is also available on more and more streaming platforms. At least I'm trying to get them on more streaming platforms. We are officially on Spotify, so you can find us there. Link, of course, on midnightauthor.com. I can't make any guarantees about other platforms, but I will do my best to get the word out there. And of course, no matter what podcast host or what podcast client you use, you can subscribe to this podcast just by going to the website and subscribing with the RSS link, which I highly recommend. That way you don't have to go through any sort of middleman. You can just get the show when it's released directly from me. And with that, I bid you farewell. Until the next time.